God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves? The murderers of all murderers. What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? One of the great mysteries of philosophy is how the great German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche died. Now, some people say it was brain cancer, some people say it was syphilis, and there's credit to be given to both of those, and I'm not going to discredit them. And in fact, I want to say something on the syphilis one before we go straight ahead. Apparently, he contracted syphilis when he went to a brothel once. So the bloke was a German incel, and then when he went to sleep with one prostitute, he then later died 20 years later. So that's one of the top explanations at the moment. But, as I say, I'm not going to discredit them. And nor am I going to discredit Nietzsche's philosophy in this video. If anything, the ideas I'm about to tell you about actually support his philosophy, at least in part. He was hitting on something. And it's because littered within his works, you can find evidence for how his mind worked. That's the point of writing, that's the point of philosophy. And in fact, Nietzsche said this himself in the first chapter of Beyond Good and Evil. He looked in the great past behind him at all the other philosophers that came before him, and he said, well, they're all kind of shit, because all they're doing is writing an autobiography. I can tell that Spinoza is only doing these things because of his personality type and because he was sick. Marcus Aurelius? He was an absolute joke. I want nothing to do with him. It's all nonsense. So he was psychoanalyzing a lot of these previous people. So the question is, why can't we psychoanalyze Nietzsche? He would, of course, have agreed with that. And of course, this is what Carl Jung did. The great German doctor, no-nuts emperor, Gustav. He gave an explanation for how Nietzsche died, and it was scattered across all of his collected works. So I've gone through and I've synthesized them all together so that we can go and investigate this together. Now, before we go on, I guess we have to preface this by saying that the human mind is a very mysterious thing, and we're still not entirely sure how it works. Psychology is only about 150 years old, and we've made great strides, to be completely honest with you, but there's still a lot of things up for debate, especially when you look at things on the political realm. If you take the more left-wing, socialist, you could even say communist-type people, they believe that people are kind of infinitely malleable, right? That we can turn people into whatever we want. Social conditioning, if you like. Whereas if you look at sort of the right wing, there is more of an idea of people have a general nature, but we can turn them into things through the virtues of hard work and virtues of piety and virtues of whatever. So there is a set nature, perhaps, but then some of it is also nurture. And Nietzsche believed very similar things. Now, he believed that we could conquer our own minds, that we can mold ourselves into whatever we chose to become. Such is the way of great men, right? If you look back at the past and you think of the men who've dominated history, you come up with names such as Napoleon, who dominated the French Revolution. You've got Julius Caesar, who is a symbol for an empire. You've got William the Conqueror, who changed the course of English history for the next 1,000 years. And what made these men great? Was it arbitrary? Was it just upbringing? Was it just genetics? Well, Nietzsche's idea was partly, yes, it was genetics, that they were genetically superior to everybody else, which is, and you could definitely make that case, at least in the particular domains in which they were specialized. We've got to be nuanced here, of course. Don't want to be mean to people. But what made them better was their philosophy, if you like, their mindset of self-overcoming, that they could mold themselves into whatever they wanted to be. And he talked about this by saying, giving style to your character, as if you were a great statue and you were just a block of marble. What these people did was chip away at themselves very painfully, using discipline, using something called the will to power, which we're going to cover in a minute, to become a great, strong man who would dominate an epoch of time, to actually transcend from human to symbol. But the question, of course, is Nietzsche right? Did he get human psychology down? Well, we'll cover that in a little bit. But one of Nietzsche's core ideas, as I just alluded to, was the will to power. And the will to power is an idea that's really quite often misunderstood. People seem to think it's just tyrannical king energy. Like, how can you crush your enemies? They think it's just the 48 laws of power that Nietzsche would have written, 100 years before Robert Greene ever got to it. And it's not quite right. The will to power is essentially creative excellence that's been grounded in the harshest discipline. So you're striving to create something great with your life, either yourself, your character, or a kingdom outside of you, or a great symphony. And you do that through, as I was saying earlier, chipping away at yourself until you are that thing. There is nothing else within you that's trying to compete. So it's basically self-improvement 101, if you want to put it like that, right? And the reason why Nietzsche liked this idea so much was because it was a way to fend off nihilism. It was a Hellenistic Greek way of viewing the world to fend off nihilism. It's pro-life, if you want to put it in those ways. Now, Nietzsche was writing around the time that, it was towards the end of when God was dying, you could say, in Europe, when science had taken over the Western psyche, and we were no longer really believing in God. And that was, of course, the quote that you saw earlier. And what this was leading to was people falling away from their healthcare system of Christianity, you could say, that was keeping them sane, and it was slowly decaying and decaying and decaying into the doctrine of equality. And he was really worried about the doctrine of equality. He saw it in the communist movements, he saw it in the socialist movements, this idea of equality above all, altruism, like pathological safety, all of this stuff. And Nietzsche saw it as a will to death. So in his mind, you've got these two competing philosophies. You've got the will to power, which is pro-life. You're born into this world, you're going to make something of yourself despite the world being really difficult. On the other side, you've got a will to death, which is I'm born and I'm just going to live to make myself safe and we can all be equal and hold hands and go kumbaya, and everyone who's out there achieving great things, well, they're being evil, aren't they? They're just evil people. They don't understand what's really the purpose of life, which is equality and cuddling each other and all of this stuff. And Nietzsche thought that these people were living in false delusion of avoiding pain, which is effectively psychic suicide before God. You're not doing anything with yourself, so you just might as well off yourself. It's exactly the same thing. Nietzsche's most famous work, his magnum opus, you could say, is Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Now, this particular work stars the title character, Zarathustra, who is this, almost, you could say, a Christ parody, if you like, because he lives on a mountain, he's doing his mountain Superman Ubermensch things, he don't give a damn what nobody thinks. He's got his strong will to power, he's being a G. And then he goes down from his mountain, and he walks around forests and villages and whatever, he gathers disciples, and he's teaching people things, he's preaching. In fact, there are even things called the Sermons of Zarathustra within the book. So clearly what Nietzsche did is he took the New Testament and went, that's a nice format, Christ is my enemy, so I'm going to sort of do a cute little parody of you and beat you. So his rival was the New Testament, which was the founding document of Christendom in the Western world. So he had big aspirations for himself, you could say that at the very least. But the difference between Christ and Zarathustra was, Zarathustra was an amoralist. Fundamentally, he was, I wouldn't really say an atheist per se, because he had higher values, he understood the psychological value of God, but he was an amoralist, and he didn't like the slave morality of Christianity. He thought that the first principles weren't solid, and that's the key point. What Zarathustra was doing is teaching his disciples to take a jackhammer to all the philosophy and all the thoughts they'd been taught and go, all of this is nonsense. Where are your first principles? And the first principle which you should be using is the will to power. That's the important part. And if you're doing that, you will one day produce this idea of the free spirit, the free human being who doesn't attach themselves to philosophies and religions. They're able to take the world onto themselves, if you like, which is very similar to what Christ was saying in a way. But there was no God in an afterlife looking forward to you, which Nietzsche thought was perhaps one of the reasons Christians became quite slave morality-y. But there's loads to say on that, but I won't do so here. But the idea of Zarathustra and the will to power philosophy is very, very inspiring. And I think even more than inspiring, it's very seductive. And of course, this is why Nietzsche is known as that philosopher who edgy 18-year-old boys fall into immediately. Like, how many people who've come to philosophy in an autodidactic manner start with Nietzsche? Like, no one starts with Kant, do they? They might start with Marcus Aurelius, to be fair. But a lot of them start with Nietzsche, and it's why. Well, you can actually use a Jungian term for this, and very crudely explaining it, but it's an idea of transference, if you like, that you can unconsciously recognize what is within Friedrich Nietzsche, when you read him, that he has a sort of energy to him. And if you've got the same sort of complexes waiting to break out, he will almost like transfer that onto you, and you can vice versa transfer them onto the text. It's very strange how that stuff works. So this character of Zarathustra was actually born during Nietzsche's time writing The Gay Science in the 1880s. So, and this was the book where, as you saw in the beginning, that quote, The Death of God, that's where that was written. And then a little bit later on in the book, that's where Zarathustra turns up. Before the book turns up, it's actually quite jarring, because he almost turns it into fiction when you're reading it, and you're like, what the hell are you doing, Nietzsche? What are you doing? But the point here is that Zarathustra was born from the death of God. So he was a character born of what Nietzsche believed to be the greatest struggle the Western world had gone through in a very, very long time. If of all time, you could even say. And Jung thought that Zarathustra was a special type of fictional character. So writers produce characters all the time. And you could say that you can just make up a character on the spot if you like. Or they could be, you know, tapping into an image of an archetype if you want to get more technical. Like Bilbo Baggins being the hero, for example. Or what's the other guy? Sauron being the evil dragon that you've got to defeat before you save the kingdom. You know, you can tap into those things. But Jung actually thought there was a level deeper than these more archetypal characters within fiction. And the most prominent example he used to point to for this was Faust. And Faust, of course, coming from Goethe's Faust, although there were many other different representations. Now, what makes Faust so special is he is a symbol, if you like, a nexus symbol, one of the deepest symbols for what's been going on in primarily the Western psyche, the European psyche, if you like, for the last 500 years. The Faustian spirit, the Faustian bargain, which essentially you could say is science versus religion. Very, very crude way of putting it. But because this video is not on Faust, we'll leave it at that. So we've been struggling with science versus religion on a political scale. We've been struggling with it on a meaning scale, on a religious scale, on a progress scale for the last 500 years. Really, it's dominated it. And so Faust was a very prominent character for this particular reason. He was born of the collective unconscious of a certain character 500 years ago, but he remained popular for a reason. That's the point. And Jung also pointed to Nietzsche and said, well, Zarathustra is a very similar character for this guy, right? Zarathustra is not normal. Zarathustra represents something. And what Jung thought Zarathustra represented was the shadow side of Nietzsche's self. That Nietzsche, like all of us, has an unconscious. And the unconscious was personified as Zarathustra. So it was a part of him that was him, but also wasn't him at the same time. In order to grip that properly, you need to understand what the Jungian shadow is. And if you've been around here for a while, then you will know what the Jungian shadow is. But just to be really brief, it's your alter ego, if you like. That you've got ego consciousness going about the world, which is you. But behind yourself, in your unconscious, there are lots of pieces of you that you aren't good at, that you aren't aware of, that you don't like very much, and they live in the realm of the shadow, that demon who lurks behind you, who's holding all these things from you. And yeah, that's what Jung thought was Zarathustra, that he represented that particular character. And there are a few things to say on this. The reason why he thought this is because Zarathustra was in opposition to the rest of the world. And the idea of opposites is going to become very, very important in the second half of this video. He was in opposition to Christendom, if you like. The world was acting in its own normal way with its own normal laws that people were interacting with, right? They formed the presuppositions people used to interact with one another. But Zarathustra was so at odds that he couldn't actually live in the normal world. That's why he lived on a mountain. He lived in the background. He lived in the shadow of Nietzsche's mind. So that's one thing, that's sort of the theory behind it. But what this means in practice is Nietzsche believed himself to be, or wished himself to be, a kind of a Zarathustra type character. And to quote Nietzsche, he would have liked to have been a man, quote, 6,000 feet beyond man and time, right? It's not, to put it bluntly, he wasn't living in reality. He wasn't quite here. He was in a mystical fantasy land, if you like. But it wasn't a fantasy land of, say, a dreaming type of person, you know, someone who daydreams a lot, who has big visions for themselves. They're not really here. They just need a bit of discipline. He was living in the shadow of mankind, and he was down there with his hammer philosophizing, like tapping at the supports of big buildings going, does this stand? Nope, down you go. Nope, down you go. So he wasn't living in reality. Jung described in his collected works that fear of insanity is the same thing as fear of the collective unconscious, which is an interesting thing to consider, because what is insanity? Well, it means you, as ego consciousness that you're familiar with, is gone. But you're still here. Something else comes to control you, right? And what Jung thought insanity was the collective unconscious possessing the ego of a human being, which is very scary. And Nietzsche lived his life being deathly afraid of going insane. His father suffered with some health problems, which led him to these certain ideas. He had some very strange things he used to write in his books, like the thought of suicide gets many a man safely and soundly through the day and through the night. Like, that's some deep, deep, deep stuff. He was dealing with some of this stuff that most of us don't normally think about. And this was very good, of course, in terms of his work, his great work, his will to power, because he operated with no rules, which was why he was able to philosophize with a hammer and why he was able to tear Christianity down, at least conventional, institutionalized Christianity down, so effectively. It's why people still revere him today as being some kind of special character who exists, if you like, 6,000 feet beyond the rest of the philosophers. No one has a following, you could say, like Nietzsche does in the field of philosophy. No one follows Kant, for God's sake. They follow Nietzsche, right? He operated with no rules, and he became his own independent man, if you like. But the problem with Nietzsche is he broke one fatal rule that the gods of the collective unconscious really didn't like. We can glean what that rule was through Jungian psychology. Now, if you read a book called Mysterium Conjunctionis, it's a very, very difficult book to read. But essentially, it's a study of opposites. That's how you could sum it up, if you like. And the psyche works using opposites. This is where Jung's studies on alchemy are very useful. He was looking at opposites, and then you synthesize them, and you produce a synthesis of something, etc. So the psyche works, if you like, numerically and geometrically. It's a little bit crude way to say, but it's a good metaphor for it. And we can begin with an example, which is consciousness itself. That is defined as subject and object. If you are conscious, then what that means is you're aware of you, and you're aware of not you. So two opposites, right? And the world is dominated by these. So just a few examples for you. We have good and we have evil. You know, Christ and Satan, if you like. We've got the material world and the spiritual world. So physics and metaphysics. We've got male and we've got female. Yin and yang. Order and chaos. All of it is dominated by opposites. And Nietzsche himself was actually well aware of opposites and used to play with them all the time in his philosophy. So take Beyond Good and Evil as a title, for example, and as a philosophy. You've got good and you've got evil. And what did Nietzsche do? He's like, no, we're doing away with those. We're going beyond good and evil, boys. And at the end of The Antichrist, he signed it off as Dionysus versus the Crucified. So once again, another opposite thing we see there. And his first work, The Birth of Tragedy, is a study of the Apollonian and the Dionysian being two opposite competing drives within the human being. They pop up all over his works, as is to be expected for someone who was so astute at psychology. So what of the will to power then? Does the will to power, Nietzsche's core idea, have an opposite? The answer to that is yes. As with every single human drive, there is opposite. Of course, there is that will to life, which is what he almost defined the will to power as, and then he reversed it with the will to death, and he had that, that's how he sort of defined it. But the will to power's actual opposite is love. Now, you might think the opposite to love is hate, because there's those two up there. You know, I love you, I hate you. In the modern world, you're not meant to say you hate anything. We're meant to go one-sided. Which, of course, is a psychically unhealthy thing to do. Human beings are naturally designed to hate certain things, although some of that comes from the shadow, of course. But love and hate are both attractive ideas. They're both emotions that operate in the same way mechanistically. Whereas the will to power is the opposite of love. And Nietzsche never really considered this opposite. And of course, the will to power is more of a masculine self-consciousness excellence idea. You know, it's very, very yang energy. Whereas love is much more of a yielding, feminine, yin energy. And he sort of gripped this. He called himself, for example, a divine feminine philosopher because he liked the idea of Dionysus and he liked music and he liked all of this stuff. But that's not love itself as a human-based emotion, as something that governs the human psyche. We all need love. All cultures dominate themselves with love. It's something which, you know, every single young child can't survive unless it has love. People get anxious and depressed without love. And that can take the form of, you know, just a mother looking after you when you're small, or it can take the form of I appreciate you. It can take the form of giving somebody a hug. You know, it could make the form of making love to a beautiful woman or a beautiful man, something like that, that side of mankind. And Nietzsche didn't consider this, and that's actually a problem. Now, let's turn ourselves onto Nietzsche as a, let's psychoanalyze him, if you like. Well, first of all, he lived alone, which is never good for anybody. He lived alone, and he was also sick as hell. In fact, he was so sick that he could barely see, and he used to, like, write for a bit, basically blinded, and then he'd go and throw up his guts and then return to work again. He was really, really sick all the time. And I'm not going to use that against him, saying he was mentally ill, because he wasn't. Not in this particular way, anyway. But so he had some suffering in his life, you could say. Perhaps more than the average person did. He also had barely any friends, and we know this through the letters that he used to write. And every woman he wrote to propose marriage to, they rejected him, sometimes not in the nicest way either. And in fact, he was so sensitive about this, perhaps because of his INTJ personality. Not Myers-Briggs, by the way, this is Jungian typology, an INTJ. He was quite sensitive about what other people might have thought about him. That after he used to propose marriage to these women in the form of letters, he used to go like, oh no, I shouldn't have done that, I shouldn't have done that. So, yeah. And the academy itself laughed at him. His lectures were actually shut down because they weren't so popular. He wasn't accepted by his own ilk. And one of his best friends and his idols growing up was Richard Wagner. Of course, Ride of the Valkyries is his most famous work. Nietzsche was really good friends with this guy. But as Nietzsche went through his life, eventually he turned against Wagner and condemned his work as being, quote-unquote, decadent. And he actually wrote a whole book as to why Wagner was decadent. Nietzsche contra Wagner is what it is called. So, with all of this being said, he lived up in the mountains. Literally, up in the mountains, the Alps. Like Zarathustra did. And he was always pushing for a will to power. He ignored all of these factors of suffering within his life, and he kept pushing for a will to power. If you read one of his last works called Ecce Homo, or as he subtitled it, How One Becomes What One Is, he actually describes his lifestyle, and it's quite amusing. I know I'm being a bit jovial with Nietzsche here today, but it was quite amusing because it was very much one of excellence to an almost autistic degree. So this is how he used to live his life, if you're interested. He used to wake up at the crack of dawn, and he used to immediately go out walking for hours and hours around the mountain, every single day just thinking to himself. And when he would come back, he would then start writing again. Now, his diet, for example, was incredibly restricted. It wasn't the healthiest diet in modern standards. He used to eat an enormous amount of fruit, for example, which is a huge amount of sugar, so maybe not the best. But he thought that was a good idea. He gave rules as to how you shouldn't have... what was it? You shouldn't really drink alcohol was one of them, which, of course, we can understand. He's trying to keep his mind straight. But you also shouldn't have weak tea, because weak tea makes you a weak man, and all these strange ideas. And he is being funny when he's writing these, but he did live a very, very restrictive, disciplined life, to the point where he actually condemned most of the Western world as being bad for thinking. You could only live in certain environments. So, for example, I'm in Manchester right now. There is no way in hell Nietzsche would have come to Manchester, because the air would have been too disgusting. The architecture would have been too disgusting. It wasn't enough to inspire him on his one unidimensional mission, which was essentially to reevaluate all values, being Zarathustra, using his will to power. That's the point. He kept himself dedicated, ignoring all of the suffering that he was doing, dedicating himself to try and overcome that suffering in his life and take all the sins of the Western world onto his back in a very unidimensional avenue. Because one of his first principles was you could mold yourself into whatever you wanted to become. And in doing so, you had to do so, because otherwise you were living a nihilistic life. There's a story that Jung tells in his seminar on Zarathustra, which is quite characteristic of Friedrich Nietzsche. And basically it goes like this. There was a dude sitting in Nietzsche's lecture one day, and he was very, very excited to meet Professor Herr Nietzsche, whatever he was called in those days. As I think we all would, if we had a chance to meet Nietzsche, we'd all shake his hand and probably give him a hug as well and go, you absolute G, Do you know what you've done to the world? You absolute legend. We love you. And this is what this little guy was doing. He's like, oh my God, Professor Nietzsche, I love you. And to the point where he actually jumped down. Well, he didn't jump necessarily, but he went up to Nietzsche after the lecture and was like, oh my God, Nietzsche, I love you. And the two of them got talking for a little bit. And Nietzsche suggested to this young kid, hey, dude, why don't we go on a school trip somewhere? Just you and me, we'll go off to somewhere really cool and we'll go study Greek philosophy and become Roman gods or whatever, you know. So inviting this young man out to explore the world with him. And this is hugely exciting. I think everyone out there, man or woman, if you found somebody who you really looked up to who said, come with me on a trip so that we can sort of become a mentor together, that would be really, really exciting. And the kid was so excited at the prospect of this. But he was living in the real world, and sadly the real world sometimes isn't as conducive to your dreams as we'd like it to be, and he remembered that he actually was dead broke, as all students are really, and he started to show it in his body language and in the way that he was speaking. So he suddenly got a bit nervous and closed off and was like, maybe I can't go actually, because, so he was wondering in his head essentially, is the professor going to pay for me? And Nietzsche, seeing this guy's reaction, which stopped being excited and started being more nervous, his response was to turn away and never spoke to the boy again. And this really wounded the boy, it really upset him. And he kept it with him for the rest of his life. But Nietzsche turned away from him. Now, imagine yourself in that student situation and to be like, why couldn't Nietzsche have asked me what was wrong? Why couldn't he have, you know, maybe offered to go halves or said, hey, maybe we can try and find a grant to help you? Or at the very least, what's up, kid? You know, like a normal human being. But Nietzsche didn't, because Nietzsche wasn't living in reality. This is Jung's diagnosis. He was living in his shadow. He was too obsessed with these ideas of the will to power that he actually didn't recognize when somebody needed some form of compassion, somebody needed help. And that was the opposite that was missing from his philosophy. So Nietzsche's life, of course, culminates in this story of him, a very famous story of him seeing a horse getting beaten in Turin. And Nietzsche saw this, he was looking from the distance, and then finally he snapped. This is the moment where everyone says that he went mad, although he was probably, you know, going downhill from a little bit earlier on. You could perhaps see it in some of the Antichrist, although I'm definitely not one of those people who thinks that Nietzsche was a madman. That's not what I'm trying to say. But towards the end, he started to slip a bit into the obsessive and the bit overly dramatic, you might say. And he snapped and he ran up to this horse and he threw his arms around the horse and he said, I understand you. Now that's not a very will to power thing to say to somebody. Like, that's not what he said to the kid, for example, in the lecture theater, but he said it to a horse that was being beaten. Now what the hell did he mean by I understand you? And we can sit here and we can talk about this for hours and hours and hours, and we'll never know. I'm never going to pretend to know. But perhaps a bit of Jungian insight here. Perhaps he understood in that moment that that was how the animal part of his mind was feeling. And the animal part meaning the human part of his mind was feeling. That Nietzsche, just like the guy who was beating the horse, had beaten that part of himself into submission, worked it to death. And all at the end of the day, it needed was a hug. Perhaps that's what he was doing. He was acting out what his psyche wanted him to do. And that's quite poetic and also really sad. But regardless of that, he then went mad. And very soon after this, he started identifying as Dionysus and the Crucified. Both of them. Whereas before, his opposites were contrasted against each other. He then started identifying as both of them. So this is that opposites idea coming up again. So both of these opposites, you could say, of love and the will to power, of Dionysus and Christ's love, if you like, had rushed up from the collective unconscious and inhabited his brain. Again, a very crude way of saying it, but his ego, him, Friedrich, was hung irreconcilably between them. I would also implore you, if you want a bit of amusement, this is technically laughing at the mentally ill, but it's Nietzsche, so it's okay, he's a famous person. This, apparently that's how it works when people are famous. But after he went quote-unquote mad, he used to write letters calling for the death of leaders in the Western world, and he wrote a letter calling for the death of the Pope. This is how you know that he's really gone a bit dramatic, you could say, at the very least. And he would sign one of them Dionysus, he would sign the next one Crucified, then Dionysus, then Crucified. He was both. And there's a very characteristic scene in Zarathustra, I'll end with this, where Zarathustra is on a tightrope hung between good and evil, over a great abyss. And of course, what Nietzsche thought everyone had to do, identifying with this Zarathustra character, was to not fall into the conception of good or the conception of evil, but was to stick to what was true in terms of first principles and balance yourself between them, to be a free spirit. But it looks like that Nietzsche did exactly that over the course of his life. But the problem was, he fell off the tightrope, because the abyss that was underneath him was Zarathustra, that had pulled up, promising to be his great heaven in front of him, but because of psychic law, had grabbed him and pulled him into the abyss. I'd like to tell one final story just to finish this video up, I guess, which is very characteristic of what went wrong in Nietzsche's mind. And it takes place after Nietzsche went quote-unquote mad, and he's sitting in his sister's house, because his sister used to take care of him for the last 10 years of his life. And his sister started to read a book to him, and Nietzsche turned to his sister and said, "I used to write really good books, didn't I?" And I don't know what his sister said in response, but that's a really sad story. It's kind of heartbreaking in a way that Nietzsche lived his life with so much suffering, and he was trying to do so much, when all he really wanted was someone to pat him on the back and go, "Hey Fred, I really appreciate this book you've just written." It must have hurt a lot when Zarathustra sold virtually zero copies when it was first released. Nietzsche wasn't famous until after he went mad, and mostly until after he died. So I guess the purpose of this story today, of talking about Nietzsche and why he went mad, is this idea of psychic balance and psychic health, especially in an autodidactic climate where we're all trying to make ourselves as best as we possibly can. And some of us are dealing with really, really difficult questions. Really difficult questions that, I guess, call into question the structure of being, the structure of reality, who you are, what truth is. Questions normal people don't deal with. And when you start using your brain to play around with all of these different things, you can, as Nietzsche put rightly, turn yourself into whatever you want to turn yourself into. But the psyche does have a law to it, and regardless of how much of a will-to-power, masculine, self-consciousness man or woman you think you can become, you do also still need a bit of a hug. Even Napoleon, he was mostly doing what he was doing, you can argue. His muse, if you like, was a woman who he wanted to sleep with, that he just wanted a bit of a hug, and he wanted someone to find him attractive. And you can find that across all heroes. If you do an exegesis on their life, there will always be some kind of human motivation down at the bottom. But Nietzsche was on his tightrope, way above being a human being. But his humanity made him snap back. And the snapback was so hard between those two opposites. Well, then he started hugging a horse. So, there you go. Either that, or he was in fact a German incel who used to run around the mountains writing ridiculously stupid books when he just couldn't get laid. That was the whole purpose of his philosophy, and we shouldn't take him seriously. So, whichever one you want, you can take your pick. Thank you everybody for listening today. If you've enjoyed this content, you have to. This is a demand. Subscribe to the Patreon down below, or else Nietzsche's unrested spirit will come and fuck you over, as they say colloquially. But I'm sure if you go check it out, I'm sure you'll find something there that you like, and it'd be really appreciated for you to, as they say in the YouTuber community, keep the lights on. Although it never gets that extreme. I don't think Shane Dawson can't keep the lights on if you don't subscribe to his Patreon. Whatever. You get what I'm trying to say. Thank you everybody for watching. Remain balanced, healthy, sane, juicy boyos. And I'll see you again next time.